Hello, everybody. Today is February 23, 2024. I'm honored to be here today with Lauren Knausenberger. In addition to all her great accomplishments, she's my former student at the Wharton School, but currently she's the Executive Vice President and Chief Innovation Officer at SAIC, which is a Fortune 500 company that provides technology and engineering services to the government. They have over 24,000 employees. And prior to being at SAIC, Lauren was the Chief Information Officer at the United States Air Force. Welcome, Lauren.
All right. Thanks, Bob. It's great to be here and great to see you.
And same to you as well. And it's always great when I see how my students and how they've accomplished so many great things. But can you just tell us a little bit about what does SAIC do and what do you do at SAIC?
All right, sure. So SAIC is a systems integrator. We provide technology and engineering services to the DoD and to civilian agencies.
DoD is the Department of Defense.
Yep, Department of Defense. And my job is the Chief Innovation Officer. I own the corporate strategy, the Chief Technology Office, the ventures arm, and the Innovation Factory, which is where we develop our digital and engineering capabilities that we use to solve problems. And we get to solve some pretty cool problems, especially on the defense side. All sorts of things like helping to create the next weapon system, doing what the military calls C5ISR, which is how you see your entire data picture for your force, how you make decisions in a fight, even how do you optimize your resources during peacetime. We play in next generation space, all domain warfighting. We have some efforts toward the border of the future. Citizen experience, and our Navy work focuses on undersea dominance. So those are kind of the five national imperatives that the company stands for. And I have the pretty cool job of making sure that our capabilities portfolio is there to solve those critical missions for our nation and to achieve the growth that we want to achieve for our shareholders, our employees, our stakeholders.
And it's interesting, before the interview today, we were just speaking for a minute or so, and you mentioned that your grandfather was involved with the space shuttle at one point.
So my my grandfather, he was the first liaison for NASA to Europe back in the 60s. And he actually was part of the mission that put John Glenn into space. And when John Glenn landed, the Glenns and actually the Von Brauns as well, were friends of the family, came through their apartment in Paris. And when John Glenn landed, my grandfather was part of the tour to, you know, to go meet the Pope and to go meet the Queen. And just, I have some fun pictures from growing up of my grandfather, you know, with the Pope, with John Glenn, with other space leaders. And of course was part of bringing in the scientist who had originally worked with Operation Paperclip from the German side, where Von Braun came from,
and the Panamande people.
Yeah, well, making sure that technology was brought into NASA and used for really great missions to come. So yeah, I had the opportunity to go see the last space shuttle launch with my grandparents, with my grandfather narrating a little bit. Oh, you know, we've stopped the shuttle a few times, and it has to take off within the next 5 seconds. You know, or we're going to lose the launch window. And I think it took off maybe 2 seconds before the end of launch window, which was just fantastic.
It's interesting because John Glenn, at least when I grew up, was an American icon, an American hero, and it's pretty neat. And so, I just wanted to talk to you about a couple areas that have been in the news lately. One is artificial intelligence, or AI, and cybersecurity. Can you tell us a little bit about artificial intelligence and how the Air Force or the United States government or your company is working with it, to the extent that you can tell us about it?
Sure. I'll start with, I guess, the buzz. And I've done a few keynotes recently where I've asked the audience, especially with generative AI, how much do people feel that it is a buzzword and we're kind of just playing, and how much do people feel this is going to change the world? And you've had some pretty high profile folks come out and say, this is going to be the next thing that really kind of turns our world and all markets on their heads. And I think it does have the potential to do that in every way. But I do think there are a lot of things that we need to figure out right now. If we look at how companies and governments are using it, there are some really great practical use cases already. I know we are trying to eat our own dog food internally at SAIC. We're using AI-assisted software development for our developers to become more efficient. I know a lot of large commercial companies are doing that. So we're able to be more efficient with the way that we develop code. It does not replace the developer. At least not yet, because generative AI, it's still kind of more of like a C plus B minus developer if you leave it to its own devices. And we don't want C plus B minus code going into weapon systems. We want pretty solid code to be going into our weapon system and space systems. We also use it just for internal processes to replace manual process in finance and program management, and to find knowledge within our own organization. Those are all things that we're doing within our company, so to improve our processes, but to get our workforce ready for the AI revolution. I was listening to a podcast yesterday, I think it was, and I don't remember who said this, but it hit me that the person opined that AI is not there to replace the human. But humans who can leverage AI will very quickly replace those who don't in the workplace. And I think definitely in the short term that that will be true. And that, you know, the more experts that I speak with and listen to, prompt engineering, a lot of folks are expecting to almost become that new middle class. Because, you know, right now you have a lot of people writing code and you have to be pretty trained to speak to a computer through code, not as trained as you did back in the Hidden Figures days of you know, programming an IBM computer, knowing Fortran and COBOL, you know, in the
Now,
mainframe.
can we just take a step back? You're talking about Hidden Figures. That was the movie about.
Oh yes, so Hidden Figures. I was actually just watching that movie last night, and that it's really the story of the Black women who were the manual computers for NASA during the John Glenn space mission, moving from calculating by hand to computer-based calculations, and especially three women, including Katherine Johnson, and their critical role in making sure that that mission took flight. Including Katherine Johnson, you know, going through and manually checking the calculations from the computer so that John Glenn was ready to take off. And I believe, you know, there were certain things in that story that they said, oh, we did that to be sensational. But I believe that piece did actually happen.
And John Glenn was a big fan of Katherine Johnson.
He certainly was.
And it was also interesting in the movie how you saw her doing the calculations by hand on a chalkboard, which people don't do anymore. And they did it and they landed it and it took off and the mission was a success. So it's pretty interesting how it did and how we've evolved since then.
It is pretty incredible, and not just doing the calculations, but inventing new math to figure out how to shift from elliptical to parabolic orbits, and you know, just really fantastic. And actually, I'll recap for the listeners. We got to chat a little bit before about how Americans are back on the moon as of yesterday. And I thought that was so wonderful. You know, the quote at the end of the movie, where the director of the NASA program asked Katherine Johnson, "Do you think we're going to get back? Do you think we're going to get humans to the moon?" And she answers, "We're already there." And it was just really neat that I was watching that movie yesterday when Americans were back on the moon, with a next generation of robots and AI to sense the environment. So it's a really just incredible time.
And it's interesting that in May 1961, when Kennedy said America should commit itself to landing in what he used the term man on the moon and returning him safely before the decade is out. At the time, we didn't have the technology for the rockets, the computers, the math, and we did it. And it was just pretty neat. And now it's been 50 years, over 50 years since someone was there. So it's interesting how it's come and just it's it, I've always been fascinated with the moon, and it's a dream that I have someday to be able to walk on the moon. I don't know if it'll ever happen,
Well, I bet we can get you to space if you really want to go. But yeah, I agree. And I look at that and there is no substitute for focus for sure. I watched Oppenheimer the other day too, about trying to catch up to an adversary that was 18 months ahead in developing the first nuclear bomb as well. When there is incredible focus with smart people, people can develop technology very quickly. And I think kind of coming back to our AI conversation, I think we're right there with AI right now, is how do we develop AI to really make a difference in our world, to make a difference in our businesses and our missions, but also a really, really strong call to be ethical about it, because we do have a limited time to shape the way that we use AI and the way that AI is in our lives, because after that it is just there as a fixture and it begins to shape our lives
And there's
more
one
so.
area I just want to interrupt. You use the term Fortran, which I
Yeah.
remember from school is an ancient, crude programming language, which has been, if that's the first generation, we're on the 10th or the 20th generation of programming languages now.
Absolutely. Well, and I would even go beyond that. But yeah, I mentioned Fortran and COBOL, because back in the day, it's like,
And
hey, you've
wait, COBOL, Comprehensive Business Oriented Language. That's another programming
yeah.
language.
Yeah, way back. And by the way, we still have people in the Department of Defense that program in those languages on mainframes today. And a lot of them are over 70, and we have to keep those guys around to mentor folks to keep those systems alive sometimes. But yes, finally computers were on the scene. You could talk to those computers if you knew how to program in Fortran and COBOL, and you'd have to carry these cards out to put them in the mainframe to compile your code. And I always kind of laugh. There's a lot of PTSD in the crews that I talk to about this from back in the day, where, oh, I was walking to the computer and I dropped my cards, and all of a sudden it's like, oh crap, what order is this code in? That's like the first cyber attack. Someone trips you and you drop your cards on the way to the mainframe.
You're bringing back some memories of college for all of us.
Yes. So now it is a lot easier to code en masse today. You have object-oriented programming, much kind of more intuitive programming languages. But where generative AI comes in is you didn't even have to learn C++,
Which is
or
another programming language.
which is a more modern programming language, but not as modern as, say, Rust, which is a very efficient modern programming language. But now you don't even need to know how to necessarily code, but if you can work through the logic and you can prompt a generative AI engine, you can get a lot of things done that way. And so that's where the field of prompt engineering, very, very clearly communicating in English or whatever language you speak to a generative AI engine, that becomes almost the new coder, the way that C++ replaced Fortran. That type of prompt engineering could replace Rust and C++. You'll still have people that need to understand the code and, down to the kernel. I think for some time, you'll have to have those experts, but more and more people will be able to interact with computers through prompt engineering, and many people already can. I'll tell you, my then 10-year-old wrote an entire three-act play using ChatGPT. She threw out what the plot was and the characters and the setting. And then she said, ChatGPT, write me a script that brings this through. So she wrote a few paragraphs and she got a whole scripted three-act play. I've written keynotes that I've then rearranged. We've written code. Folks have gotten generative AI to come up with new molecules to test for new drugs. And that is especially fascinating to me. What if you can throw a molecular model at a generative AI engine and you can test new drugs and almost virtually do a trial, even before there's animal or human testing, just based on all of the mapping we've done of the genome, all of the data that we have, and to tweak that model over time? It is fascinating how we can use these technologies to go so fast.
And the listeners should understand that this script that you and I are going through now, which isn't a script, was not done by ChatGPT or any sort of AI along the way on this. But it's interesting that what you could have AI do, and it just the possibilities just are beyond, I guess, what our imagination is. I mean, I'm thinking about it. Alfred Nobel developed dynamite, and he never thought it would be used for destructive purposes in terms of people. And it was. And, he had, so you don't know what sort of genies we're unleashing when we open up the bottle here.
It's absolutely true. And Elon Musk famously said AI is more dangerous than nukes. Vladimir Putin said he who owns AI owns the world, something along those lines. He who is first in AI rules the world, I think was more the nuance. So it's absolutely true. And you asked me about kind of military applications of AI. I think in some ways the military uses AI the same way other people do. You have airmen using ChatGPT to make a PowerPoint presentation or to grab data from different sources, and Guardians as well, by the way. So the Department of the Air Force includes the Space Force. So I got to be the CIO of the Space Force as it launched, and the Air Force, which was an incredible honor. So there's those things that are just like how you would use AI anywhere else. But then there are things like, how do you use an algorithm to optimize where your fighter jets will meet a tanker plane to fuel midair while you're doing operations in the Middle East? That used to be a whiteboard exercise. Think Katherine Johnson writing on a chalkboard, but it was a battle-tested commander writing on a whiteboard in a kayak in the Middle East. And the commander says, "Hey, whatever you do, don't disrupt my whiteboard." Cyber attack would be someone wipes the whiteboard. And that now is an algorithm. So the in-air refueling, and I guess I'll take a step back. The fighters, they go off and do their mission, and there is literally a tanker that aligns above the fighter jet. And they're a certain number of feet apart, and basically a gas pump comes out the back of the big plane and attaches to the fighter jet midair. They're going over 300 miles an hour at the same exact speed. They fuel in midair, and the fighter goes back to the next mission. And that was done by hand for a while. And it's only been in the past, it was during my tenure, that they made that an algorithm. And they were able to save $250,000 a week on fuel. And they were able to save about $500 million a year on wear and tear and maintenance on the tanker planes by making that an algorithm that they tweaked over time. So the mission applications are pretty great there too. Being able to dynamically optimize your resources for war gaming and preparing for a real fight. Those are all things that AI can really help with. And there's at least one disaster that I think we possibly could have averted if we were using AI. You probably saw the news article a couple years ago where the Iranians just accidentally shot down a Canadian commercial plane because they thought that it was a plane that was coming into their airspace to attack them after some other actions in the Middle East. And the operator was under stress and trying to figure out, is this a threat or not? If there were an algorithm there, it could have seen, this is a commercial jet, this is a normal path, or it diverts only this much from a normal path, seems to be on this trajectory. We can pull in this other data. And then you have an algorithm that is not stressed, that is not thinking about, am I going to get fired? That is making a very logical decision based on only data, rather than a lot of things coming down on that human at that moment. So, I've always advocated for having a human in the loop to make a decision, but having AI feed that, give that decision, that human everything they need to make a decision. I know the Secretary of the Air Force recently came out and said, if the human's always in the loop, we're going to be too slow. And I agree with that too. The humans need to give very clear guidance for what goes into that algorithm. And we also need to be very clear on where we want a human to hit the button and say go, and where we want the human to set criteria. And when that criteria is met, we go. A real red line.
So, it's interesting when you look at all this, you say, well, the possibilities just seem like endless. And you and I could both agree that they've probably not even scratched the surface in terms of how we could utilize AI and maximize the use of our equipment in the Air Force, the Army, even on a street. But what about streetlights and how do we time those so that they're even better? And then when looking back, you say, when they landed on the moon, when they went to the moon, in the late 60s and the 70s, it's my understanding the computers did not have enough memory to have the coordinates to come back. They had to radio it to them so they can know how to come back. And now we're talking about precision, and it's pretty neat.
It is pretty cool. Now, granted, there are still a lot of systems out there that still rely on their radios. But there are, even for the systems relying on radios, there is more AI in the networks to capture this much data and pull it back to the folks that need that data. So, agreed, it's a really fantastic time.
So it sounds like what you're doing is extraordinarily interesting and it's really benefiting all of us. But can you just talk a little bit about cybersecurity and how big of a threat that is? Because when you're reading the news, you see the stocks that are going up, they're the ones that are tied to AI or cybersecurity. And you think about everything, whether it be our cars, our thermostats at home, let alone our defense systems, are all tied and are all could be victims of cyber attacks.
Absolutely. And what's really scary is that you see the companies that are in AI and cybersecurity going up in the market. What you don't see is the so cybercrime doesn't trade on the NASDAQ. And cybercrime, the last time I looked, and it's been probably a year, was around a $6 trillion a year market. Which makes it the, if cybercrime were a company trading on any of the markets, it would be either the biggest company in the world, or yeah, $6 trillion annual revenue. Yeah, that would
That's
be up
pretty
there.
sobering. That's the
That's
thing.
yeah. And so there's a big profit motive there. So it comes down to first ethics and people not doing it or using their powers for good. I'm glad that we have monetized ethical hacking and gray hats, folks that you pay to hack your business. I'm going to pay you to hack your business so that when someone comes to hack my business, to steal my data, to sell it to an adversary, a competitor, whoever else on the dark web to the highest bidder, that you are the one hacking me and telling me how to be better. Rather than someone else stealing my information and monetizing it that way. So I think anytime we shift the market toward ethical hacking away from cybercrime, I'm a big proponent. And I'm also a big proponent in general of open hacking of systems. We did it a lot in the Air Force. We'd say, hey, come hack our satellite, come hack our airplane, come hack our systems. And actually through some of those things, we had folks hack the Air Force cloud while I was there as well.
You
And
paid these people to do this.
we paid people for the things they found. Yes. And in fact, one of the things that one of the groups found, we contributed back to open source because we were leveraging an open source, a very popular open source technology. And we found a vulnerability with that. And through our Hack the Air Force effort, we contributed back to that open source tool that a lot of different companies, just about every company uses. And so kind of close that threat vector. But yeah, cybercrime is a huge threat. Things are happening all the time. And it's everyday people that are hacking, and it's nation states that are hacking. And the nation states that are hacking are they're very well resourced. They're doing it every single day. And so if there's a different threat profile where so Bob Chalfin would be more of the everyday hacker kind of, hey, protect your network, protect your bank account, protect your personal information. But if you're the Department of the Air Force, your adversaries are trying to steal the missile diagnostics or the airplane design. If you're a company, maybe another nation or another company are trying to steal the formula for the new drug that you just put out to market, or the chip design that you just put out to market. So it is very interesting, but there is a lot of effort that's being put into protecting systems. A lot more over the past few years in being able to see your cyber posture more easily. A lot of education in companies and among people on what you can do to protect yourself. And of course, number one is just do your very best to not be a target.
And it's cumbersome because we all now have to enter codes and passwords, and have double checks on them.
Multi-factor authentication. Yeah.
Multi-factor. Yes. But is there anything else that you want to add? Because this is fascinating. And I'm going to ask you before we conclude, just one more. I'd like to see if I could get one promise out of you. Is that if you'll allow me to interview you again on a future
podcast? Sure.
But yeah, is there anything else that you want to leave the audience with?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, I could talk about cybersecurity and AI all day. I guess the main thing is AI continues to rule the world. Continues to shape the world. Let's work together to develop the technology to do things that are really good for people and our world, and to be very ethical. Same thing on the cyber side. Let's be really smart about how we protect our data, and let's work together to to be ethical in that domain as well. And to be smart and leverage cyber hygiene as well as cyber protection. But the really crazy thing there, we're going back to geeky math. There is something called Shor's algorithm that runs RSA, and one of the major ways that we encrypt. And there is a concern that over the next 1 to 10 years that someone will crack Shor's algorithm and all encryption that we know it will be broken. And by the end, and also the second that someone gets to about 1,000 useful true units of quantum, that we will effectively have no encryption until we get to a true post-encryption world and can leverage the new type of encryption. But we'll still have the same problem. It'll be a higher stakes cat and mouse game of what is the cybercrime market? Who has adopted the new technology? Maybe for a period of time, it'll be really well-resourced state actors. But then after that, everybody's going to figure out how to work in the new world, and there'll be a new cybercrime market, but it'll be a quantum cybercrime market.
Well, Lauren, I thank you very much. I am proud, but not surprised at how well you've done. And I'm looking forward to interviewing you again in the future. So thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bob. Great to be here.
Hello, this is Bob Chalfant. The second edition of my book, A Practical Guide to Buying a Business, is now available. This book, along with my book, A Practical Guide to Selling a Business, can be purchased on Amazon. All proceeds received from the sale of my books are donated to nonprofit organizations.